Good evening, Evergreen. I appreciate you joining me for this study in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians entitled Living the Future Now. We're in the fourth chapter this evening, and I want to start with a quotation that comes from a section of C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, a section that I've read over and over again through the years. C.S. Lewis describes the life that we're called to live as believers. He gives this illustration to paint a picture of who we were meant to be. Imagine yourself as a living house. God comes in to rebuild that house. At first, perhaps, you can understand what he's doing. He's getting the drains right and stopping the leaks in the roof and so on. You knew that those jobs needed doing, and so you're not surprised. But presently, he starts knocking the house about in a way that hurts abominably and does not seem to make sense. What on earth is he up to? The explanation is that he is building quite a different house from the one you thought of. Throwing out a new wing here, putting on an extra floor there, running up towers, making courtyards. You thought you were going to be made a decent little cottage, but he is building a palace. One of the problems with American Christianity in our generation is that too many people who claim to follow Christ have this idea that Christianity is primarily a belief system, that you mentally agree with a set of propositions, and if you believe the right things, then God comes and he sort of remodels you. He dresses you up. He helps you be a little bit better than you could be on your own. The fact of the matter is that's all wrong. Christianity is not just about what we believe. What we believe is important. Doctrine is significant. Truth is explained by the content of the gospel. But it's not just signing off that, oh, I believe those things. Christianity is fundamentally a transformation of life. It is God not just sweeping out the house and cleaning us up a little bit. He's not even coming in to detail it and make it look fresh. He's tearing down the old, the broken, the damaged, and he's building something else. Paul uses the phrase a new creation. And so when we examine Christianity from the standpoint of total overhaul, of demolition followed by divine construction, that's a very different kind of Christianity than American Christianity, which really just shoots for respectability. It shoots for morality. It bothers me sometimes. I hear people say, when I talk to them about faith, you know, one of the standard questions over the years, you tell me you're a Christian. Tell me why you think that. What is it in your life that gives you confidence that you're a Christian? And I'd say the number one answer is, well, I'm a good moral person. Okay, that would be great if that was the standard. If God was just shooting for you to be a little bit better, your better parts outweigh your bad parts, you know, heaven is a 51-49 proposition, and if you can just, over the course of a lifetime, get a little bit more in that ledger on the good side, then you're good to go. The problem is, that's not the standard. It's never been the standard. The standard is perfection. The standard is Christ-likeness. Christ lived a life without sin. That's the only way into the presence of God. Except Christ made a way for those of us who could never reach that standard. He came and provided himself as a substitute to pay the penalty for our sin. So now we can be in relationship with God. But here's the thing. Even if you understand that, the Bible doesn't stop with getting a ticket to heaven punched because you've prayed a prayer of salvation. Christianity is a transformative lifestyle, which means that we have practical cooperation with the work God is doing in us. In other words, we're helping with the demolition and we're contributing to the construction. God is doing his work in us, but we are with him in the project. Chapter 4 of 1 Thessalonians is Paul talking to us about the practical side of pushing towards sanctification. Now, sanctification, that's a big theological word. It simply means a life set apart to accomplish something specific, sanctified, holy, made something by God that it could never be on its own. We have a part in that process. We cooperate with the process of sanctification that God is doing in us. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. In the first verses, he's going to command us to be holy. Look at the first 8 verses of this chapter. Paul says, finally then, brothers, again, let's stop right there. We stopped at the beginning of chapter 3 because he started that chapter with therefore. Chapter 3 was the concluding argument to everything he had laid out in the first 2 chapters. The therefore tied back to what was behind. In chapter 4, Paul starts this chapter with the word finally. Not meaning that this is the last thing he's going to say, but meaning that he's making a sharp turn. He's been describing what they believe. He's now making a sharp turn into the practical. And he's going to talk to them not just about what they believe, but about who they are, how they live, the kind of life that they walk with in the sight of God and other people. Finally then, brothers, we ask and encourage you in the Lord Jesus that as you have received from us how you must walk and please God, as you're doing, do so even more. For you know what commands we gave you through the Lord Jesus. For this is God's will, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality so that each of you knows how to control his own body in sanctification and honor, not with lustful desires like the Gentiles who don't know God. This means one must not transgress against and defraud his brother in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger of all these offenses, as we also previously told and warned you. For God has not called us to impurity, but to sanctification. Therefore, the person who rejects this does not reject man, but God, who also gives you his Holy Spirit. All right. He's going to start in these verses by commanding us to be holy. Christians are to conduct themselves, Paul wants us to understand, Christians are to conduct themselves in a distinctly Christian way. When we're commanded to be holy, what he means is we're supposed to live in a way that pleases God. And here's the thing, holiness is not optional for a Christian. It is a moral imperative that flows out of the relationship that we have in Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus didn't provide a way for us to be saved, to be washed from our sins. He didn't do that so that we could sort of get cleaned up and then go on our way about our own business. There is an explicit obligation tied to that transaction. We have been bought with a price. What Christ did for us, when it's applied to pay our debt. See, we owed the debt of our sin. Now we owe the debt of our salvation, if you will. In other words, your life, my life, it's not our own to do with as we please. So to be like Jesus, to pursue holiness, is not optional, but we do know that it's pleasing to God. So the best motive is that we live in a way because we want to bring pleasure to God. We want to bring honor to Christ. But Paul's going to let us know that even if we don't reach for those good motivations, the fear of discipline, while not the best motivation, is a motivation for us to live the life that we want to live, that we're called to live. Now, when we talk about discipline, people will take that and they'll say, see, I knew God was out to get me. I mean, he just looks for ways to punish us. All right, let's review. We live in a culture, I see too many parents these days that have lost this understanding of what discipline actually is. They often think that if I discipline my child, little Johnny won't like me. I want him to like me. Listen, you have to make a decision somewhere along the way as a parent. You can either be the parent or you can be the buddy. Now, it's fun being the buddy, but Your job is to be the parent. You see, we have a generation that by and large doesn't know how to fend for themselves because they were never raised to make decisions and know what to do. Mom and daddy were helicopters. They hovered around them and took care of everything. You need to understand, discipline is not an ugly word. It's not a bad thing. In fact, we use it in lots of other ways that are eminently positive. We say, well, how did you win the gold medal in the Olympics? Well, it took a lot of discipline. What does that mean? It means I got up early. I trained. I gave up other things because I had a goal in mind. Discipline is simply the control of your life, the control of your body, the control of your mind, because you have a goal in mind. Parental discipline, for example, is not just random, arbitrary punishment. Parental discipline is something necessary because the parent has a goal in mind that is, a responsible, contributing, productive adult. That's what I'm raising up. God disciplines his children not because he's mean, not because he's impatient. He disciplines us because he looks at us and he says, I've torn down what was there, what was damaged, what was scarred by sin. I'm building up something new. But demolition has to take place before construction can be put in place. And so Paul is calling us to this life of cooperating with God. He tells us that we have to have a single-minded spirit to do this. In those first verses, he said, I'm asking you to do what you're already doing. Now, that's a great compliment to this church. I told you that the Thessalonian church was probably one of the healthiest churches in the New Testament era. And Paul holds them up earlier in the book as a model to other churches. He lets them be on display for other churches to see the way you should do church. But he wants them to understand that no matter how good you are as a church, no matter how solid you are as an individual believer, we are in a process of building a life that is always commended but never completed, at least not in this life. We're never fully like Jesus. We're never entirely the body of Christ that we were meant to be. So even a good church like the Thessalonian church, Paul says, I want you to take what you've been doing and I want you to do it even more. Because you know, those are the commands we gave you through Jesus. And then he makes the most important statement in this sentence, in this paragraph, verse 3. And this is simple. People ask me all the time to help them discern God's will. Usually when people ask me that, what they mean is I have a particular decision. I have a relationship question. I have a job selection question. I have a purchase question. I have a specific circumstance in my life, and I need to know whether to go left or whether to go right. I want to know God's will. What we most often misunderstand, though, is that while God is concerned with those kinds of details, frankly, those decisions, if it's not something wicked, those decisions are usually pretty insignificant in light of the big picture. Well, I want you to, I have this job offer and I have this job offer and I need to know what to do. Well, God will probably give you direction if that really is a significant decision. But sometimes you don't get a clear answer because God's saying, I can use you in either situation. His real significance, as far as his will goes, is right here in this verse. For this is God's will, your sanctification. In other words, the bottom line of every other decision you make, every other circumstance of your life, everything that God is doing in your life, every situation, every trial, every spiritual battle, every advance, every retreat, everything in your life is about this. God's will is for you to be fully sanctified. That is to be like Jesus Christ. When you want to make a job decision, you want to make a relationship decision, you want to make a purchase decision, every decision must be made in light of that part of God's will that is already obvious to us. If this purchase, if this job, if this relationship draws me further from sanctification and Christlikeness, then that's not God's will. If this job moves me forward, if this this relationship advances me in the faith, if this purchase makes me stronger in my service to Christ, okay. We're trying to figure out God's will in the details. When the details play out pretty obviously sometimes, if we understand the underlying will, that is, this is God's will, your sanctification. Now, Paul's going to give two examples. It's not an exhaustive list, but he's going to give two examples of what that entails, what being sanctified looks like. They're both negative, okay? We know the positive side of sanctification is to become like Jesus. To be holy is to walk in a way that reflects the Spirit of God that lives in us. But Paul knows that sometimes it's easier to define something by what it's not. And so that's what he does here. He says, this is God's will, your sanctification. Verse 3, he says, that you abstain from sexual immorality so that each of you knows how to control his own body in sanctification and honor, not with lustful desires like the Gentiles who don't know God. Now, this is this word that's translated in my Bible, sexual immorality. It's the Greek word porneo, which is obviously where we get our word pornography. But in Greek, it's an umbrella term. It has to do with any kind of sexual behavior that is unacceptable. It can be premarital sexual relationships, extramarital sexual relationships, homosexual relationships, pornography, anything that is considered to be outside biblical parameters. And so he says, I want you to understand that a single-minded spirit is necessary to be a part of this process of sanctification. And so he immediately begins with sexual sin. Because, at least for men, if not for women, one of the great mental battlefields in our development as believers, as followers of Jesus, is in the area of sex. And the reality is, sex is often, the sexual issues are often a battle that's really won and lost in the mind, but it plays out in the body. So Paul shows the reverse process. He says, I want you to understand how this works. In order for you to pursue sanctification, there are some things that you need to avoid. The first on his list is abstain from sexual immorality. But then he says this, so that each of you knows how to control his own body. You see, what he's telling us, this is discipline, personal discipline. It's a fruit of the Spirit that's called self-control. What he says is that when we fight the fight against sexual immorality, we are taking control over our bodies, which allows our minds to build a fortress against the sexual temptation attacks that come against us. He says, I want you to control your own body in sanctification and honor, not with lustful desires like the Gentiles who don't know God. You see, the culture in the first century Roman Empire was frankly much like our culture today. It was highly sexualized. Sexual images were prevalent. Out of bounds sexual behaviors were accepted and flaunted. Part of the decline, part of the destruction of the Roman Empire was the implosion from the moral depravity that came to be commonplace and normal in Rome. Now, we could make some historical arguments that America's future looks bleak if we continue on the road of sexual activity that we're on right now. But Paul's not making that point. He's not trying to save the Roman Empire. He's talking to a church. And he says, God's will for you as an individual believer, as a collection of saints called the church, God's will is for you to be sanctified, to be holy, to be Christ-like. So that the starting place for that is control your body against the onslaught of sexual temptation that comes at you from the surrounding culture. The Gentiles who don't know God are subject to those lustful desires. They dominate their lives. One thing that we can say in America is that those who don't know Jesus, sexual topics, sexual images, sexual behaviors, they are the dominant focus in the brains of most human beings in our generation. Paul says, don't be like that. Pursuing Christ-likeness is, by definition, a countercultural attitude. It's moving in an opposite direction from the rest of the culture. Paul says, control your body against sexual temptation, because that is part of the way we demolish what was defining our lives so that we can make space for the new construction that God is doing. He says not only the first issue of that he says is not sanctification is this kind of sexual immorality. Avoid that. But then he switches, and we know he switches because he changes the kind of language he uses. In verse 6, he says, this means one must not transgress against and defraud his brother in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger of all these offenses, as we also previously told and warned you. Now, it's easy to misread that, because if you read verses 4 and 5, and you're following this line about sexual immorality, and then it'd be easy to say, well, verse 6 seems to say that there's something about defrauding a brother in this matter of sexuality. But here's where knowledge of the original language comes in, because when you diagram these sentences, part of the reason you diagram sentences in Greek is so that you can find what the subject is and what the main verb is, and then you can see what each phrase modifies. And so verse 6 is not tied to the whole question of sexual immorality. It goes all the way back to the beginning and modifies the main part of the sentence, which is, this is God's will, your sanctification. So let's say we've already covered the sexual immorality part. Paul says, avoid that, fight against that, stand against that, control your body against those temptations, because that compromises this process of constructing a holy life. But now let's set that verse aside and jump straight from the main subject to verse 6. Let's read it this way. For this is God's will, your sanctification. This means one must not transgress against and defraud his brother in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger of all these offenses. One of the things that Paul is saying here, he switches from the language of sexual temptation to the language of business dealings. And he says one of the ways that we pursue sanctification, in the same way that we set aside sexual temptation, we have to set aside the temptations that come to defraud people in business, to cheat people, to have dealings that are dishonest with people. He's going to give us these two examples. Basically, follow Jesus. What that means is try and be like him, make decisions like him, walk like him, treat people like him. But don't give into sexual immorality, and don't give into the temptation to take advantage of people. In fact, Paul uses the language here that he says it's a particularly heinous crime when you defraud a brother. In other words, when you have faulty business dealings with a member of your own church family. I remember about 25 years ago, one of the most uncomfortable pastoral moments in my ministry was a business dealing between two church members that went sour, and one felt like he hadn't been paid properly and the other felt like he'd been cheated out of what had been promised. And they came to me to mediate that disagreement. It was an eye-opener for a young pastor. What Paul is saying here is when that kind of thing happens within the church family, it's even worse than what's typically seen out in the world. There is a breach of trust between family members when there's that kind of inappropriate business dealing in the church. Listen, I hate to break it to you, but if there's a disagreement between two people in the church over business or anything else, the teaching of the New Testament is both sides should work to outdo the other one in making it right and making it easy for the other person. See, that's exactly the opposite of what our culture teaches. Our culture says, I'm going to get what's mine. You owe me. I deserve this. In the New Testament, if there's a disagreement between brothers, they should both be in a position to go out of their way to make things right, even to their own disadvantage. Say, well, what if he won't do his part? Am I supposed to just give in 100%? Well, actually, that's what the Bible teaches. But here's the hidden part of that. You say, he wronged me, but I'm supposed to give in 100%. Well, that's not fair. You're right, that's not fair. But did you hear what Paul says in this verse? He says, don't transgress against and defraud your brother, because the Lord is an avenger of all these offenses, as we also previously told and warned you. Listen, somebody in the church does you wrong, you can fight the fight just like the world does, and you can both embarrass the reputation of the church, you can damage the name of Christ, or you can both try and do what's right and make it up, even if it's to your disadvantage. If one of you doesn't and the other one does, the one who takes the hit, the one who accepts the disadvantage, the wrong, he does so with the guarantee that God doesn't allow fraud and cheating to go on inside the family of the church. God becomes the avenger. That's what the word means. God becomes the avenger of that offense. Listen, I promise, whatever it is you'd like to do to that person who wronged you, it's nothing to what God's going to do. But it's a matter of faith. It's a matter of sanctification to say, in this situation, I'm going to step back and leave it in God's hands. You see, Paul's given us this. I told you with the word finally, he shifted into real practical stuff. The Christian life is pretty easy to live if it's just about believing some things. Oh, I believe the golden rule. Oh, I believe the Ten Commandments. Oh, I believe the Sermon on the Mount. But what happens when you actually have to live those things out in real life? It gets messy. But that's why Paul wants us to understand God's will for us is to become like Jesus. That process called sanctification means there are some things that we do intentionally. We discipline ourselves to do those things. But there are other things that the culture offers us that we refuse to do. We refuse to go into sexual immorality, to make that normal, to accept that as a way of life. We refuse to cheat or break trust with members of the church family. We refuse those things, even though the world says, oh, that's not a problem. It's okay. It's just the way the world works. Man, I can't tell you the number of times over the years I've had a Christian who was upset with another Christian who wanted to respond in a fleshly way, and I've tried to talk them back from that ledge, and they'll say, but that's not the way the world works. No. You're right. The world works differently from that, but this is the way the kingdom works. And if you're pursuing sanctification, you have to decide whether your loyalty is to the kingdom or to the world. Because you can't do both. You can't do both. Commanded to be holy. That's what these verses call us to. A single-minded spirit and then a sanctified body. This part's about controlling your body. He says in verse 7, for God has not called us to impurity, that is anything that's related to the demolition side of life, but he's called us to sanctification. That's the construction side of life, what God is up to. And then verse 8, therefore, the person who rejects this does not reject man, but God, who also gives you his Holy Spirit. Think about that. Paul is calling believers to commit themselves to the process of daily sanctification. And he says, if you don't want to go down that road, It's God himself into whose face you are spitting. Remember what he said in the early, in the early verse, verse 3? This is God's will, your sanctification. When you and I choose to sin, we tend to put that in the context of, it just hurts me. Okay? It doesn't hurt anybody else. It's just me. It's not anybody else. But what you've got to understand is, God's will, his design, his purpose and plan, he bought you. His will is your sanctification. So when you and I willingly choose the demolition side of life, when we choose to sin, when we go into pornography or sexual misbehavior, when we conduct ourselves without integrity, with a lack of ethics in our business practices, when we choose to go in those directions, Paul makes it very clear, it's God that you're rejecting. There is no such thing as an innocent little sin that doesn't hurt anybody. Sin by a believer is a slap in the face to God himself. Why? Why? Because God's will is your sanctification. We're commanded to be holy. That's the first 8 verses of this chapter. Let's look at the next verses. In verses 9 and 10, we're commanded to love. These are great verses. He's just talked about sexual immorality, and then he moves to this business about cheating a brother inside the church. And that takes his line of thought to the relationships of the church family. And so he says this about brotherly love. You don't need me to write you, because you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. In fact, you're doing this toward all the brothers in the entire region of Macedonia. But we encourage you, brothers, to do so even more. All right, a couple of things in those verses. That place where it says you've been taught by God to love one another, that is a brand new Greek word that Paul invented. It's the word that can be literally translated God taught. In other words, you've been taught to love one another not by anything that you learned in kindergarten, not by anything that the culture out there tells you, not by any standard of the world. The call to love the brothers, that was a God-taught thing. You see, we go back to Jesus talking to the disciples, and he said, the world's going to recognize that you belong to me by one very specific and practical observation. They're going to see how much you love each other. Within Christianity, the defining characteristic of Christianity to the outside world has always been the same thing. It's not our orthodox theology. It's not our benevolent work with the nations. It's the defining part of our testimony, our witness to the world around us, is that we love one another. That is the bottom line characteristic. Why are so many churches unattractive to the people in the city where those churches try and operate? Because if you ask the reputation of the church, you'll get a lot of different descriptive terms, but they won't say, oh, those people love each other. You see, love within a church is a powerful appeal, invitation, draw to the surrounding culture, because the surrounding culture has no place they can go where they are truly loved. That is the definition of a church. We're commanded to love one another. Now, Paul says, you are doing it great in Thessalonica. Man, your church, you are practicing love. But just like what we said earlier about how being holy, being sanctified, is something we're perpetually pursuing, but we never quite get there. So that's what he says about this. He at the same time, he says these two things. He says, you're doing this. You're already loving one another. You're doing this toward all the brothers in the entire region of Macedonia. But we encourage you, brothers, to do so even more. There wasn't anything lacking in what they were doing. Paul's not saying, you're doing okay, but you've got some gaps that you need to cover. No, he said, you haven't left any gaps. In the whole region of Macedonia, you are loving the brothers. Now do it more. With more intensity, more fervor, spread out beyond the boundaries that you've already set for yourself. Our love for the brothers is intended to start here and go out. And as more and more of the brothers and sisters find their way into our sphere of influence, we practice love. Let me give you a couple of examples about this. Let's talk about the nations. We had to cancel our trip to Nicaragua next month because obviously the coronavirus, and Nicaragua is a dangerous place right now. They still have not closed their borders, and so it's really, as far as the virus goes, it's a very unsafe place to be. So we've had to step back and cancel a medical clinic trip that typically, on an annual basis, we usually see somewhere between 300 and 400 people come to know Christ because of the week that we spend with the people in different villages doing medical clinic and presenting the gospel. Well, when we cancel a trip like that, my thought immediately goes to, how do we make up for 400 people that were going to come into the kingdom by hearing the gospel, and now we're not going to be there to tell them? The Bible is very clear. How will they believe unless they can hear, and how can they hear unless somebody tells them? So, because some of our people going on the trip have not asked for their money back, they've donated it towards Nicaragua. They paid for their trip. Their trip was canceled, but they've left that money in our hands. We are able now to secure pastors, national pastors in Nicaragua. We are funding them to do evangelistic crusades in our absence. We have purchased rice and beans that they're going to deliver in the villages to help people get through this time of crisis in their country. And between the humanitarian side of delivering food, rice and beans, and funding the ability of local pastors to do evangelistic work that they couldn't afford to do otherwise, the travel and accommodations necessary for that, my prayer is that we will see 400 or more people come to Christ because of the resources that we're doing. You see, that's not just about money. It's evergreen, expanding our love for the brothers to do more than we've already done. All the way to Nicaragua. We're not going, so how can we make up for that? How can those people hear the gospel? How can new believers come into the kingdom? We're going to do that as best we can. Well, let's talk about something closer to home. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago about the coronavirus economic stimulus payments that the government is making available to people. I told you, if you haven't lost your job, if that money just kind of fell out of the sky and you don't have to have it, we've made it possible for you to donate that money to the church. From a real practical standpoint, that means a charitable contribution credit that will come to you. But if you donate that money, we've set aside a specific fund, and we've already, even though the dollars haven't started coming in from the government yet, we've had people already begin to contribute to that because we're planning to use that fund specifically to help mitigate the economic impact of all of the business closures and all of the quarantine-related economic hits that people are taking. People in our church are beginning to lose their jobs. They're struggling to pay their bills. We're going to take those dollars and use those to help offset some of those hits. Why? Because we're family. And even though we love the brothers well here, we're taking this verse to heart. Paul's going to say, you're doing it well. But I'm asking you, do it more. Do it further. Do it with more intensity, more intentionality. Love the brothers more. When you find that money in your bank account, before the enemy tells you all the new things and toys that you can buy with it, let me suggest that you just offer it back to the Lord. Put it in a donation to Evergreen, because here's my promise to you. It will go to help people in our church and situations that we are drawn to help offset the damage of this, of these events in recent days. It won't be for anything else. It'll go for that. You put it in our hands, and on your behalf, we will find the situations where we can make a real difference, and we'll do that. It's just about us loving the brothers even more than we already have. Commanded to be holy, first 8 verses. Commanded to love, verses 9 and 10. Now verses 11 and 12, he's going to command us to live Christ. Look at these verses. At the end of verse 10, we encourage you brothers to do so even more. He's talking about the love for the brothers. Then he says, to seek to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you, so that you may walk properly in the presence of outsiders and not be dependent on anyone. Now this is actually pretty fascinating, because Paul's going to tell us three things that we need to avoid. And actually it's pretty relevant right now in a time of isolation and quarantine. He says, I want you to seek to lead a quiet life. That phrase, quiet life, is really it's kind of an oxymoron. Paul uses a strong word. It's actually the word ambition. And he puts it next to a soft word, the word quiet. And he basically says, I want you to lead a quiet, ambitious life. In other words, he's not telling us to sit on our backsides and not do anything. He wants us to be ambitious. He wants us to move forward. He wants us to accomplish things. He wants us to have productive lives. But when he modifies it by saying, I want it to be a quietly ambitious life, he's telling us that he wants us to avoid restlessness and then meddlesomeness. I want you to seek to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business. Those two phrases go together, because he says, I want you to be quietly ambitious to live your life for Jesus, and I want you to stay out of other people's business. It's fascinating. There's a word that has sort of taken off on social media. It's the name Karen. I don't know if you've heard this. If your name is Karen, I apologize. I didn't start this. This is just what it is. A Karen is a word that has come to describe somebody who's a busybody, who's in your business. When in social media, when somebody jumps into a conversation that they're not really a part of and they try and tell people what they ought to do, they're described as a Karen. Well, Paul didn't know that phrase. He didn't know that title. But that's what he tells us. He says, I want you to be quietly about your own productive life. Now, we're going to find out this is a significant thing later. He's going to talk about being aggressive in your ambition, not just sitting around waiting. We'll see in the next chapter, why that's an issue for Paul. But he says, I want you to lead a quietly ambitious life, but I want you to mind your own business. In other words, I want you to work to have a balanced, calm life. Let's talk about this. I mentioned recently that part of what this quarantine has done is it's allowing us to take some inventory. Our schedules, by and large, we're so busy that we were just running from one thing to the next thing all the time. The Christian life is a life that understands what's important, what we're called to do, and what's peripheral that we just occasionally allow ourselves the time to do. But our culture is so driven to do it all that we allowed ourselves to be piled on by everything we were trying to do. We were juggling so many balls, we were spinning so many plates that we didn't do anything well. Well, this quarantine has shut us down. And we've realized that some of those things that were so important, we don't even miss them. This is a perfect moment to reboot, to reset our lives. When things begin to open back up, as I hope they will in the next few days, we don't want to just jump back into what we were doing a month ago. We want to add back in those things that we have discovered to be important, to be crucial. Have you been having a quiet time in quarantine? It's been great because you've had time. Well, guess what? You don't give that up when you get back into a more active lifestyle. You keep that and you leave out some other things that have fallen away. When he says, I want you to have a quietly ambitious life, he says, I want you to go in a direction that you mean to go on purpose, but I want you to have a calmness about you, a balance to your life. Christians were not meant to live in a fractured, harried, crazy, busy world. We're meant to live on purpose, understanding that eternity breaks into time and space through us, and we have to give time to eternity in our lives so that it can break into the lives of people around us through us. Live a quiet, balanced, calm, purposeful, ambitious life. And then he says, and mind your own business. Oh man, I don't know how people do it. Busybodies, that it exhausts me when people have to be in other people's business. Basically what Paul means by this is live your life as though everything is between you and God. You don't have to feel obligated to correct every other person in the world that you know that's doing something wrong. Partly because, I don't know, you're not the Holy Spirit. Listen, one of the things people think about pastors is they think we just walk around swatting people's hands and telling them what's what. You know, I know who I'm responsible for. I'm the shepherd of a particular flock, and it is my job to nurture, to protect, to feed, and sometimes to correct my flock. It is not my job to correct everybody else in the world. You have to know your sphere of influence, your family, the brothers and sisters in the faith that you have a relationship with. You see, in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus gives us guidelines of how to approach a brother that dabbles with sin to help pull them back to safety in the heart of the family. I'm not saying that we're never involved in the lives of other people, but you understand the difference. There's a difference between going to a family member and saying, man, I'm worried about you. I see this happening and there's a brick wall at the end of this road and you are blazing full speed right into it. Come back from danger. Okay, we understand that. That's not what Paul's talking about. Paul's talking about that self-appointed person who just thinks they know how everybody else ought to do things. Don't be that person. To use popular terminology, don't be a Karen. He wants us to live Christ. That means be productive, be quiet and balanced and calm. Mind our own business. That means live as though your life is just between you and God, that you're not responsible for everything else that's going on in the world. But then he says this, and I want you to work with your own hands as we commanded you. The other thing he wants us to avoid is idleness. Now, he's not saying that Christians here have to be manual laborers. That's not what work with your own hands mean. What he's talking about is that he wants us to be responsible for providing for ourselves and our families. Christianity is never separated from the day-to-day realities of life. This is not just a Sunday dress up, go hear a lecture, and learn intellectually about some belief system. Christianity is a transformative lifestyle that plays out in everyday life. Now, what we're going to find out about the Thessalonian church, it was one of the best churches of the New Testament. They just had one problem, and we're going to run into it soon. Paul is laying the groundwork. We're going to find out that there were people who were expecting Jesus to return so imminently, so quickly, so immediately, that they had quit their jobs, and they were living off of the provision of other members of the church because they were just waiting for Jesus to return. And Paul gives us one of the great practical principles in all the New Testament. He says, you tell those brothers that if they don't work, they don't eat. This is a great principle when it comes to the church practicing benevolence. Benevolence is meant to help in a crisis. Benevolence is meant to get people through a rough stretch. Benevolence is not meant for the church to take on responsibility for someone's bills perpetually. Years ago, there was a couple in the church that came to me and said, man, we've had some medical bills, we've run into some problems, and we can't pay our, utilities. Is there any way the church could help? I said, yeah, we can do that, and we'll help. Paid their utility bills. They came back the next month and they said, man, we're still struggling and we can't pay our utility bills. Would you pay our utility bills? And I said, well, okay, we can do that. They came back the third month and they said, man, we're just not out of a hole yet. We can't pay our utility bills. And I had to sit down with them and say, listen, I need to know your plan. Okay, I'm not the long-term answer. The church is not the long-term answer to your budget shortfall. What's the plan here? And they got mad at me and they left the church. But I think I was on pretty solid ground. Because Paul says at the same time, love the brothers more than you've already been doing. But then he turns right around and says, but tell them, if they don't work, they don't eat. See, right here, when he says, I want you to be responsible to work with your own hands, he's saying you need to be the kind of person that solves your problems. The church is there to help through rough patches, through difficult circumstances, through unforeseen events. But these people in the Thessalonian church, they were just living off of the good graces, the generosity of other people in the church. Paul said, that's not what we do. That's not the way this works. And so while we are generous in our help to brothers and sisters, it's always with an understanding that help is to help them get back on their feet, because they're called to live a life of productivity. They're supposed to be responsible for their own walk with Christ. The goal in life is to live for the reputation of Jesus and to have financial independence. Now, that doesn't mean financial independence like the way we use it. When we say financial independence, we mean rich. You know, we don't ever need anybody. Paul just means financial independence in the sense of being able to pay for your own bills. See, that's how he finishes this section. He says, I want you to live a quietly ambitious life. I want you to mind your own business. I want you to work diligently with your own hands. Why? Verse 12. So that you may walk properly in the presence of outsiders and not be dependent on anyone. Those two things. Here's the goal of the life that he's describing. He wants us to live a life that outsiders look at and see Christ in us. And he wants us to not be dependent, not require perpetual assistance from the rest of the church. You see, the goal of believers is to never, I mean, sometimes, and it's hard, sometimes you have to be the receiver of help. That's hard. But those times come in life. Things happen that are unfortunate, that are difficult, and the church helps. And it's a very humbling experience when the church helps like that. But the goal of every believer is to be on the giving side of the help, and not on the receiving side of the help. You see, that's why Diane and I, as we talked about this $1,200 that the government says is coming, we're glad, we're grateful that we're not right now in a situation where we need to receive help. We're thrilled to be on the side able to help, able to provide the help. And so as an act of faith and trust in our God who takes care of us, that's what we're going to do. And the day that money arrives, there'll be an electronic donation as I put it into the hands of Evergreen so that needs of the brothers can be met. My invitation is for you to do the same. You follow the leadership of the Lord. Every time giving comes up in the Old Testament or the New Testament, here's the principle. Every time it says that giving is done as God moves their hearts. Don't do it for your pastor. But if the Spirit of God moves your heart, do this. Join us. Because there are brothers and sisters, maybe you don't even know their situation, but it will come to the church. We'll find out and we will help and we'll make a difference because we want to be a church like Paul describes here that knows we're God taught to love one another and we're doing it as best we can and we're doing it well, but we want to do it more. Well, the last point of this chapter, I've called it a command to encourage. This is the section about the rapture, and I just don't have time to do that right now. So here's my promise. If the rapture doesn't occur in the next 7 days, then next week I will teach you what Paul tells us about the rapture. If the rapture does occur in the next 7 days, then you won't need me to teach you about the rapture. So either way, let's look forward. The end of chapter 4, the first part of chapter 5, we're going to talk about the rapture of the church. We're going to talk about the day of the Lord and those eschatological, those end times lessons. We'll box those together next Wednesday when we come together online, and we'll see what Paul tells us. One good thing about it, there's a lot of speculation about the end times. A lot of people, think they know this or they think they know that. Paul's going to tell us, you can believe what I say here because this is by the revelation of God. In other words, what we're going to see in the next few verses is not just Paul doing his best guess. He's going to tell us what God's Spirit showed him and gave him permission to write down and be preserved for us. So we will see some things about what's coming in human history when we meet together next week. Evergreen, God bless you.